Thank you for tuning in to PRI's The World. For the past 30 years, Public Radio International has brought you important stories from remarkable people, informative news, unique voices, and a vital connection to ideas and cultures across the nation and around the globe. The mission continues, but we can't do this work without your support. Please visit PRI.org/give and contribute today to support some of the best of public radio. And thank you.
A threat against LA schools, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Los Angeles schools were closed following an emailed threat. This student says her non-English speaking parents were confused.
They're not going to know what to do because they don't know in what ways to help.
Plus, Marco Werman and our team in Kenya with stories about women doing business there and the challenges they face.
I think we're our own worst enemies, where if you have stuff you're doing, your own friends or family would be the last guys to buy.
And a crisis manual for Muslim American women.
It's reached the level where it's survival now. We have Muslim American women that were born and raised in the United States that feel uncomfortable walking down the street of their hometowns.
Those stories ahead on The World. We begin, though, in Los Angeles, where more than 500,000 students did not go to school today. The L.A. Unified School District was shut down because of a threat officials said arrived via email.
Somebody has sent information that leads us to pause and make sure that we are safe, that our children and our staff are safe.
That's Ramon Cortinez, the school superintendent in Los Angeles. The threat raised fears of another mass shooting like the one in nearby San Bernardino 2 weeks ago. And that's left many in the region feeling jittery. Saul Gonzalez of Station KCRW has been to two different L.A. schools today. He says the school evacuations were remarkably efficient.
By the time I got to the schools, I got there about a half hour, 45 minutes after word first came out. The schools were largely emptied out. The one was a small elementary school. The other one, Venice High School, a very, very large, typical urban campus here in Los Angeles. And 99.9% of the students were already gone.
So the threat came in after students had already arrived at school?
They were had just arrived or were still arriving. At the high school, I talked to students who said, you know, they heard about it on the way to school. Some of them started getting text messages and phone calls from their parents saying, you know, don't go to school today, turn around, come right home. So a lot of them never even got to campus in the first place. Those who did get to campus, they were greeted by their principals or teachers at the school and told, you know, no, there are no classes today.
How is the LA school district different from others?
This is a school district, really, of immigrants. I mean, a lot of the students are immigrants. Certainly a lot of the parents are immigrants. So, you know, this is not, the LA Unified School District is not necessarily your typical parent is, you know, soccer mom and dad driving a Volvo SUV. I mean, these are a lot of very hardworking people who worked, you know, who work in the restaurant sector or work in local factories. You know, that was one big challenge today is that, you know, it's harder for them to get off work simply because they don't have the kind of jobs where they could just go, you know, go ask the boss, hey, you know, I have to leave for an hour or two to retrieve my child. So it's also a district where, you know, because it's so immigrant heavy, a lot of the parents, even on the best of days, may not really fully understand what's happening in the schools. So you throw something like this at them, hey, we're going to have a mass evacuation, please get your child as quickly as possible. It's a real challenge for a lot of parents, and a lot of them are relying on public transportation.
I'm assuming a lot of immigrant parents may not speak English, which brings me to this clip you provided us from Venice High School. It's from a senior you spoke with today named Leslie Ramirez. I know Venice is on the west side of LA. Here she is describing her experience getting to school.
None of the school buses came, so I decided to come in the metro. And I was thinking, I'm going to be late to school today, and I have finals. And when I arrive, the whole school is empty.
Leslie Ramirez's parents are Spanish speakers. They had to retrieve three kids in different parts of L.A. So this has been quite an ordeal for parents, hasn't it?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, particularly in light of just what happened 2 weeks ago. I mean, here we had the worst terrorist attack since 9/11. That's fresh in people's memories with the tragic shootings of, you know, a couple of weeks back and not so far from Los Angeles. So, And now this happens. It's already a region on edge because of that. And I think right now, I think there's already conversation starting to happen as to, you know, whether or not this was necessary to evacuate all the schools, to close all the schools for the day. But I think a lot of people, frankly, are saying, yeah, right on, do that. Do whatever you think you have to do to keep our kids safe, because, you know, it's been a crazy last few weeks, both in this country and around the world.
Saul Gonzalez is a reporter with KCRW in Santa Monica. Thanks, Saul.
Hey, thank you so much.
A lot of people across the country are on edge right now, including many Muslim Americans who feel unfairly scrutinized because of their faith, which is why the website MuslimGirl.net has just published a crisis safety manual for Muslim women. The site is geared to help empower Muslim women in the U.S. and abroad. Amani Al-Kadotba is the editor-in-chief.
It's really unfortunate that we've had to resort to that because of the fact that Muslim American women are often the most vulnerable because of the fact that many of them choose to wear headscarves and therefore are publicly identifiable for their religion and for their faith, which is why one of the suggestions that we make or that we offer for Muslim women is to maybe change up the style of their headscarf to make it more religiously ambiguous. For me and my friends, one of the first things that we do whenever there's a media frenzy like this is we style our headscarves in a turban style, because for many of us, that makes us look more religiously ambiguous and it looks more trendy and doesn't seem so obvious that we're wearing a scarf on our head for religious reasons. Again, these are literally like last resort options where we're trying to place the safety of Muslim women first and foremost, but they should never feel like they need to, you know, switch up their identity or the way that they choose to dress for religious reasons just to acquiesce hateful sentiments that are taking place around them.
But isn't changing how you wear your headscarf doing exactly that?
It's more so telling of the situation that we're in, right? I mean, it's reached that point where Muslim women feel forced to have to conceal their religious identities in order to avoid the violence that's being perpetuated against them. You know, it takes into account that earlier this year during the Chapel Hill shootings, three Muslim American students were shot execution style within their own apartment, and two of those students were Muslim women that wore headscarves. So it does make them public targets. So at this point, whenever these situations happen, and the reason why we created we felt the need to create a crisis safety manual is because it's reached the level where it's survival now. We have Muslim American women that were born and raised in the United States that feel uncomfortable walking down the street of their hometowns. And I think that that's where, you know, we need to focus, where that's where our attention lies, is what are we going to do to really address these racist and hateful sentiments head on and change the quality of life for Muslim Americans? Because, you know, they have their rights to religious freedom that they are entitled to just like any other American. And it's important for us to make sure that they feel safe living here at home.
What's been the response to your crisis safety manual?
I think that amongst Muslim women, the response has been more so exasperated than anything. I think that a lot of us feel exhausted and we're kind of used to it, right? Like at this point, it didn't seem like a shocker to us that a crisis safety manual needs to exist now for Muslim women in order to know how to live and how to address these situations when they arise. So from what I've seen, it's like, wow, you know, it's reached this point. Like now we have had to resort to this, right?
Are you taking some of the steps that you recommend in the crisis safety manual yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, is that a lot of the points that are in the crisis safety manual are from real life experiences and like basically tactics that Muslim women have been implementing since 9/11. So these are things that are kind of, you know, pointers that we discuss between ourselves with our girlfriends and things like that. But this is the first time where we've actually laid them out and outlined them into an online resource that we want to make publicly accessible to anyone that needs it.
Do you wish you had had some sort of manual, you know, when you were growing up and experiencing things like this?
Yes, I really do wish that I had some type of manual like this when I was growing up. For me, 9/11 happened when I was in fourth grade. So I was 9 years old. And the fact that the probably most heightened Islamophobia of modern history that we've had to experience, that taking place during my formative years, you know, growing up, going through puberty, it really was very emotionally taxing, very confusing for me. And I felt very alienated and ripped apart from society. So I think that Muslim Girl is kind of like a product of that, right? So this is basically exactly what I wish I had when I was that age. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to create some destination online that young girls and young women can have today and that our daughters can have later on down the line that we didn't have access to when we were that age, because we want to make the future brighter.
Amani Al-Khattabah is the editor-in-chief of MuslimGirl.net. Thanks, Amani.
Thank you so much.
President Obama yesterday called on Muslim nations to step up and do more in the fight against ISIS. As if on cue, a few hours later, Saudi Arabia announced the creation of a coalition of 34 Muslim nations to fight terrorism. Details are sketchy, but the U.S. has welcomed the move. My BBC colleague, security correspondent Frank Gardner, says it's a pretty diverse alliance.
It's being headquartered in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, and 20 out of those 34 countries are African nations, some of which you will have heard of as having already a major problem with Islamist insurgencies, countries like Nigeria and Tunisia and Chad, but other ones which really haven't popped up on the counterterrorism map, places like Djibouti and Benin. So some quite small countries in there, but it's a big alliance. And the fact that it's being led by Saudi will mean it's no surprise that Iran, its big regional rival, is not in it, nor is Syria and Iraq. And those are, well, certainly Iraq and Iran are Shia majority countries. So it's slightly a reflection of the rivalry between the big Saudi Sunni powerhouse and the Shia one in Iran.
Now, what does it mean to be based in Riyadh, and what are these countries going to do? Is it kind of chatting about what to do? Is it actually doing things, you know, air attacks? Is it intelligence? What do we know so far?
They haven't given full details. They're basically saying nothing is off the table. And in fact, in the last few hours, the Saudis have announced that they are in discussions with their allies, the Emiratis from the UAE and the Bahrainis, about sending special forces into Syria. This would be really quite a departure for Saudi Arabia. It's already bogged down in an intractable war in Yemen, a civil war. So this is a quite sort of surprisingly aggressive, some would even say almost imperialistic foreign policy. But they will be pulling the strings because the operations center is going to be in Riyadh. They're going to be looking at all ways of tackling terrorism, funding, ideology, as well as on the ground. But look at the countries where so-called Islamic State is most active, Syria and Iraq. Those two countries' governments are not included in this coalition. So it's really not clear how the Saudis are going to conduct counterterrorism operations in those countries without the permission of their governments.
Now, President Obama has been hammering on Muslim nations to take a more active role against ISIS. Is what you're hearing close to Obama's vision of what that means?
Well, I can't believe it will come as a complete surprise to the State Department. They must be aware of this. It all depends what it's going to do, because, you know, this could potentially, if this goes the right way, this could be very effective. And the Saudis have certainly been stung by a number of international criticisms leveled at them. One is that they're not doing enough for Syrian refugees. The other is that they are partly responsible for the misery taking place in Syria because ISIS is in some ways close to their very narrow-minded Wahhabi ideology, which in some cases becomes sort of what's called Salafist jihadist. The Saudis say this isn't fair because they are a target of ISIS and that ISIS would love to overthrow them and take over the Grand Mosque in Mecca and so on, which is certainly true. But there's no getting away from the fact that over 4,000 Saudis have gone to join ISIS. There's still a lot of popularity in Saudi Arabia for what ISIS stands for. They see it partly as a bulwark against Western secular democracy, which they don't like, but they also see it as a bulwark against Iran and Shiism, which they consider to be heretical. So the Saudis are to some extent reacting to international criticism that they're not doing enough to combat ISIS and its ideology.
The BBC's Frank Gardner. Thanks, Frank.
You're welcome.
A heads up before the break. Marco Werman's in Kenya this week, reporting on women whose business is their own. Today we meet a woman who gave up her day job in order to be a fashion designer.
No one wanted to be associated. It's like, what? You leave your job to become a tailor. So very few, like maybe 2-3 of my friends actually supported me in the early days.
But now she's owning it. Her story's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. A year ago this week, the U.S. and Cuba embarked on a new era. They started a thaw after decades of icy animosity. But what's really changed since then? And what's still the same, despite all the talk of a new openness across the Florida Strait? Washington Post reporter Nick Muroff is in Havana. Let's start with your top things that have changed.
The biggest thing is just that it feels like, you know, the future is here, that for 50 years, a big part of what's defined Cuba has been tensions and its animosity between the government and the United States. Now things are moving past that. And, you know, I think for a lot of Cubans, they know that Raul and Fidel Castro are leaving the scene fairly soon. And there's a kind of an excitement for the future to get here. And for some, that's also creating, I think, some impatience for that to happen faster.
What about kind of the people you see in Havana these days? I mean, do you see American businessmen and women that you wouldn't have seen before?
Yeah, it seems like everyone has sent down a team or a delegation to kind of feel things out. I think a lot of them have come away with the impression that Cuba's still not quite ready to embrace American businesses. And they've also learned that the embargo is still a major obstacle to trying to do anything in a serious way down here. But in addition to all the CEOs and business folks, we've seen dozens of U.S. senators and representatives. And it's all kind of added to this sense that Cuba is, you know, at the center of things, you know, and that was reinforced too by Pope Francis's visit. And then now we've got talk of Obama wanting to come before his term ends.
But of course, he's put a caveat on that, that he'll only visit if he can meet with Cuban political activists.
He said he wants to be able to meet and speak with anyone that he chooses. And that means Cuban dissidents and opposition groups.
I'm curious, are Cuban activists feeling the weight being lifted from their shoulders since normalization between the U.S. and Cuba?
Actually, it's sort of the opposite. If anything, I think the past year, a normalization with the United States has put the government a little bit more on alert and has increased its determination to prevent any kinds of act of public protest. Practically every Sunday, when the Ladies in White group in Havana or the Patriotic Union of Cuba group in Santiago try to march, they are picked up and taken away in buses. So it's a sign to the degree to which the jolt to the status quo, so to speak, has left the government a little bit jittery as well.
What about the expected rise in tourism? Has that happened?
It has happened. I think things are only getting warmed up here in some ways. It's led to a scramble among Cubans to renovate properties and rent them out for tourists. And that's a way that hard currency is getting directly into the hands of ordinary Cubans.
What's your favorite and least favorite change?
My most favorite change is the 50-odd Wi-Fi hotspots that the Cuban government has opened up because it's made this place a little better connected than it has been in the past. The least favorite change, well, I guess I would say the least favorite change that hasn't happened is the U.S. and Cuban governments haven't come to an agreement yet about regular commercial flights between the United States and Cuba, and the main way to travel is still on very expensive charter flights that are a real pain.
Now, lastly, Nick, I see that a couple of Cuban baseball stars are returning home for the first time since deserting to join the American big leagues. What's the buzz there about the Major League Baseball tour?
You know, Jose Abreu and Yasiel Puig are the two biggest stars who are coming back. Both of them defected within the last few years. I think there's a lot of excitement, and it's one more sign of the way that players like that are no longer considered traitors to the revolution and are viewed rightly as treasures for, you know, Cuba's national pastime as well as the U.S.'s national pastime.
Washington Post reporter Nick Miroff in Havana. Thanks a lot, Nick.
Thanks, Carol.
Like most nations, Colombia tries to market itself as a tourist destination. It's got a lot going for it, beaches, mountains, colonial cities, but Colombia also has a rough reputation to overcome. Not that long ago, it was one of the most violent places on Earth. The World's Jason Margolis traveled there recently.
When I told friends and family that I was going to Colombia, I got the same reaction over and over again. Are you crazy? Colombia has really cleaned up its act in the past 15 years, though, but perceptions are lagging. The new Netflix show Narcos isn't helping.
During the early 80s, the best smuggler in the world was Pablo Escobar. He was a living embodiment of the Colombian dream. And with the money came the violence.
Narcos tells the tale of drug lord Pablo Escobar and weaves in stories of Marxist guerrillas fighting the government. The 10-part series is graphic and violent. And fascinating. I liked it. Colombians I met did not.
It's annoying because Colombia is so many things, so many good things.
Pablo Limon is a PhD student in engineering at the University of the Andes. He says Pablo Escobar is a tired story. He wishes Hollywood could find something else to say about his country.
I used to live in New York. My name is Pablo, and everybody would say Pablo Escobar, and I had that joke always. So if I understand it, but I don't like it.
But here's a different way of looking at the renewed fascination with Pablo Escobar. It's getting a lot of people talking about Colombia.
I believe that everything can contribute to the promotion and everything that contributes to see Colombia in a different way.
Maria Claudia Lacartour is the CEO of Pro Colombia, the government-funded organization that promotes the nation's international tourism. You may be wondering, how exactly does a bloody and violent TV show promote Colombia? Well, again, it's piquing interest in Colombia. Also, Narcos is well shot. It shows off things like the picturesque steep hillsides of Medellin and the Andes. Lacartour says that can help change how people think of Colombia.
And that is something that will attract and is actually attracting people to come to Colombia and see what we have to offer. When they come to Colombia, they will realize not only what we used to have, but the beautiful things that we have.
Lacartour went on to chronicle those beautiful things. That's her job. That's also Mark Genny's job. He runs private tours, mostly for Europeans and North Americans, with the company The Colombian Way. But Genny doesn't sugarcoat things.
The government's very good at putting out promotional images and saying, look, what great food we've got, what great different climates we've got. Look at this picture of a plant or an animal somewhere. But there's only that many times you're going to read about soup or the variety of fruits or different dancing. And I think they could do things that are more practical.
Practical things like paying more attention to the main tourist draw in Bogota, the colonial city center.
It's dirty. So if people say, you know, the center of Bogota is really dirty and it's a bit edgy after dark, fix that.
Genny isn't saying don't visit Colombia. Far from it. He's just saying know what you're signing up for, then sign up.
The reasons you think why would you not come to Colombia are actually one of the reasons to come. It's been in the wilderness in terms of tourism for up to 60 years. So if you're an explorer, if you want to see somewhere that's not overrun with tourism, Colombia's an ideal destination. That would be my reason for coming.
Colombia has recently grabbed international attention for another thing besides the TV show Narcos. The leftist guerrilla group FARC appears close to signing a peace deal with the Colombian government. That could officially end Latin America's longest war, which has killed more than 200,000 people since 1964. That could go a long way to rehabilitating the country's image. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, we meet some women in Kenya who ditched their jobs and started designing clothes. At first, not even their own friends and family would buy from them.
It was an embarrassing thing, actually, to say that you're a designer. And now I find more and more Kenyans are buying it, which is lovely, and it makes me really happy.
Women owning it in Kenya, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International, with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. This week I'm sitting in for Marco Werman while he's on assignment in Kenya with our team covering issues across women's lives. And Marco, I know you've got a couple stories for us. Where are you right now?
Right now I am in the Ngara Market here in Nairobi. Ngara is the big vegetable and fruit market. I am surrounded by pineapples and cabbage and gourds and corn and onions. I mean, everything that you can possibly imagine growing in the tropics. And I will come back to the subject of produce in just a moment. Also in a few minutes, Gina Moore will be here. She's BuzzFeed's international women's rights correspondent and is based here in Nairobi. And today she's going high fashion on the world with some of Kenya's top women designers who are owning it, but finding some major challenges along the way as they set up business. And, you know, business is why we're here in Kenya, Carol, with the Across Women's Lives team. It is all about owning it and how women are gaining greater empowerment through business. But first, I'm going to take you a day's drive outside Nairobi. We went last week to Western Kenya to the shores of Lake Victoria. The reason is sweet potatoes. And I know that may sound crazy, but let me explain. This is a 5-room hospital in Homa Bay County. Mostly women are seated under the veranda trying to squeeze into a small bit of shade left by the midday sun. They are waiting their turns, some with illnesses. There's one man with a head injury. But many of these women are here either for prenatal or postnatal visits. One woman has just given birth, and her healthy baby has been weighed. It's mostly what you'd expect. The new mothers and the mothers-to-be are given advice. Babies will be vaccinated and vitals taken. But the women are also waiting for coupons. Coupons for discounted sweet potato vines. This is part of a prenatal health program launched by the American Health Organization, PATH, and the Kenyan government. The idea was to create an incentive for women unaccustomed to prenatal visits to go get them and give themselves and their babies a better shot at good health. The incentive was sweet potatoes, orange flesh sweet potatoes. Kenya already has white and yellow sweet potatoes, but the program wanted to get at something that those varieties don't offer, a way to increase intake of vitamin A, important for boosting the immune system. Patrice Akinyapio lives in the community and works as a liaison between the clinic and the mothers. She pulls a whiteboard away from the wall to show me the change in the number of prenatal visits. Patrice says the hospital had been simply giving out vitamin A supplements to new and expectant mothers.
But when the orange flesh sweet potato came into the existence and we taught the pregnant mothers on the importance in orange flesh in relation to vitamin A, we realized that very many children are consuming orange flesh at the household level.
The program clearly was having an impact on vitamin A intake, but it also seems to be shifting the fortunes of the women who are growing the sweet potatoes. The vines they get after their hospital visits, they plant them, get extra food for their families, and any surplus they can sell. A mile or so away from the clinic, David Elijah stands in a field of sweet potato vines.
I'll come into my farm and cut some pieces of vines.
He's the local source. A woman with coupons will buy them from him at a subsidized rate.
These are the vines which I provide them to go and plant in their farms. I'll give 100 Kabode and 100 Vita to go and plant in his farm.
Kabode and Vita A are nutrient-rich varieties and fast-growing. The women can harvest 3 crops a year as opposed to 2, so the potential for profit is big. Beatrice Otieno is one of the women who has benefited. I walk through a field moist with rich red dirt to get to her home. Beatrice is 27 and well into the pregnancy with her third child. Her first 2 children she gave birth to at home. But because of sweet potatoes, she's planning to deliver number 3 at the hospital. We stand in a patch of sweet potato vines she planted earlier this year. Beatrice tells me that knowing she can get sweet potatoes from her prenatal visits also made her realize the importance of giving birth at the hospital. She knows she'll be safe there in case there are any emergencies. Making sure mothers have healthy babies isn't the only goal of the program. Helen Nyongesa Malava works for PATH in Homa Bay, and she tells me a shocking statistic. In this part of Kenya, 27% of the population is HIV positive.
We know that because of the high HIV incident in Homa Bay, we are promoting prevention of mother-to-child transmission.
There are indications that the vitamin A in orange flesh sweet potatoes is helping to curb that transmission because it's an immune booster. Still, it can be hard to get women to the clinic. There's a superstition in this part of Kenya that if you talk about your pregnancy, you will miscarry. And then there's a challenge of where women would plant sweet potatoes. In Kenya, men own almost all the land.
But part of the reason why this was identified as a site is because of the willingness of households or men participation in ensuring that they'll be able to show their women where they can be able to cultivate the vines that they are given.
At the hospital in Homa Bay, the proof of concept lies in the numbers of women who are showing up for prenatal visits. Beatrice Otieno, the pregnant mother whom I met, is one success story. And every day there are more women taking the same interest in sweet potatoes and the health of their babies.
Margo, it's Carol back in the studio in Boston. I have a question. The program clearly is succeeding in providing important nutrition and health care for these women in this part of Kenya. But what about the business side of it? I mean, when we're talking about owning it, about women getting into a business like selling their sweet potatoes, how's that working out?
Well, you know, once I left Beatrice Otieno and her field of sweet potatoes, I headed back to the sweet potato nursery, and that's run by that man we met, David Elijah, a man. He's selling the vines, they're subsidized, of course, to the women. And, you know, like I said, they can sell the surplus that they don't eat. And I'm sure there are some women who are ambitious and are making some decent money from that. And as Path told me, go to the supermarkets in Nairobi, like Nakumat, you see orange flesh sweet potatoes. They see that as a success. Although I have to say, just walking through the market here, I couldn't really find any orange flesh sweet potatoes. Still, the men are willing to fork over land for this. So that is a positive change. And, you know, the fact that sweet potatoes have been a kind of catalyst for better women's health and gives them the potential to enter the marketplace for a product that, you know, from what I've heard, people seem to prefer over the white and yellow varieties. That was impressive and a winning combination. So, from sweet potatoes to a completely different subject now, fascinators. And one thing I know for sure about this next story is that you can't eat fascinators. Gina Moore from BuzzFeed is with me. She's their international women's rights correspondent, as I said, based here in Nairobi. Gina, what is a fascinator?
A fascinator is, if I can say so, the most bold and the most misunderstood fashion accessory that exists. It's these tiny little hats you wear on the side of your head like a British princess. And there's a woman here in Nairobi who's making a really good living selling them. The reason I like fascinators as a symbol of Kenyan fashion business is a lot of women who started out in this business, even making clothes, were misunderstood at the beginning.
Darling, for years I've been called a tailor, a seamstress.
That's Deepa Dosaja, the woman behind one of Kenya's most successful clothing companies. She's been in business here for 25 years, and it took a while for people to figure out what she was doing, to really get that a woman with a sewing machine can be more than a seamstress.
Hi, Wanjogo. How are you?
Charity Kiarye owns Boutique Mahali.
I'm good. So that plaid fabric, you guys sent me the wrong fabric.
Her boutique is famous for edgy designs in so-called African fabric, which features those bright colors and fabulous patterns. But Kiari's special genius is designing to cut those fabrics just right so that the line of a dress or the waist of a pair of pants really makes the pattern pop. Kiarye actually set out to be an entrepreneur. When she quit her corporate job to strike out and build her own company, she lost a lot of friends. And even her family wasn't totally sure about her full-time move into fashion.
My dad, when I told him I'm quitting my job, was just like, just don't come ask me for money. I guess maybe he thought I'd be looking for capital. My mom was hesitant to refer her friends until I had basically earned my stripes.
3 years later, she's got those stripes. She employs 10 tailors, which is still not enough to keep up with her growing demand, and she's expanded into menswear. She's the go-to designer for occasion outfits. Think something for a cocktail party or a wedding. And she's shown her stuff at African Fashion Week in London. But for her and for other Kenyan women, this kind of success comes with a price.
I used to have very, very many friends when I first started out this business. And then no one wanted to be associated. It's like, what? You leave your job to become a tailor. So very few, like maybe 2-3 of my friends actually supported me in the early days.
The world of women's empowerment tends to assume that women want to help each other out. But that's not always how it works here.
A lot of women, and not just African women, I think we're our own worst enemies. Where if you have stuff you're doing, your own friends or family would be the last guys to buy.
That's Muthoni Waweru, who runs a business called Hat Couture. Waweru imports fascinators, those small eclectic headpieces beloved by British royalty, especially Kate Middleton, Prince William's wife. Waweru got into the business because she wanted to wear a fascinator at her wedding, but she couldn't find an affordable one in Kenya. So she sells her hats for between $20 and $40 each, and her business is especially brisk this time of year. Holiday parties are huge in Nairobi, and women use Muthoni's fascinators to add pizzazz to their party dresses. But not even her clients are totally happy for her.
There's still that feeling of maybe I'm helping you too much or, you know, you're only ahead because I bought from you.
Designer Deepa Dosaja has pushed through those tough early years when no one really understood what she was doing. But she stuck with it. Her clothes caught on and her clients multiplied.
It was an embarrassing thing, actually, to say that you're a designer. And now I find more and more Kenyans are buying it, which is lovely. And it makes me really happy.
Which Kenyans? Well, Oscar-winning actress Lupita Nyong'o, for starters, who wore Dosaja's pink silk jacket and matching skirt with her trademark hand-painted flowers on her recent visit home to Western Kenya.
That was Gina Moore with BuzzFeed here in Kenya with that wonderful story about some of the women players here in Kenya fashion. Another way women are making it and owning it here in Kenya. Gina's going to be back with us tomorrow on The World. So Kenyan women designers making stuff. There are lots of women here owning it because they're making stuff. And at PRI.org, you've got to check out what some other women all over the globe are making. We've got a terrific feature online called She Made It. The Ethiopian woman, for example, who started a cool little shoe company called Soul Rebels, she made that. Or how about the Burmese woman, I Kin? She lives in San Francisco, and along with her husband, they created seedies, little colored balls filled with wildflower and herbal seeds that you just chuck in your yard and help repopulate disappearing bee colonies. The aim, to seed 1 billion wildflowers across the U.S. Very cool stuff. She made it. That's over at PRI.org. And Carol, one more thing before I leave you today. No matter where you go in Kenya, you will always find matatus, the minivans and buses that transport people through the cities and across the country. It's a profession that's almost exclusively male. No more, though. We've got the video story of one of the very few women matatu drivers in Kenya. If you know the culture of the matatus, it's really rough and tumble. So this woman is kind of a badass. Day in the life of one of Kenya's rare female matatu drivers. That's at PRI.org. Signing off today from Nairobi, Kenya. Back to you, Carol, in Boston.
Thanks, Marco. Our team in Kenya will be back tomorrow with another Owning It story. We go on a tour of an aloe plantation run entirely by women.
So welcome to the aloe plantations.
How do you actually harvest the leaves?
You just cut with a very clean and sharp knife. You just cut it here.
Their aloe goes into Western cosmetics, and the profits support their village. That's tomorrow, right here on The World. Before our next break, we want to help you out with your holiday shopping. You know, in case you're still looking for that perfect gift, we asked some of our correspondents to name the best book they've read all year. Here's one suggestion we think you'll like.
Alan, this is Daniel Esterin. I'm a reporter in Jerusalem. I'm really liking a new book that came out about the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. It's called Killing a King by journalist Dan Efron. And you probably remember this. 20 years ago, Rabin was making strides toward an historic peace with the Palestinians when a young religious Jewish Israeli law student shot him dead after a peace rally. The assassin was convinced Rabin was going against God's word. And actually, today, the assassin has a lot of supporters in Israel. Dan Efron lays out the story like a political thriller novel, except every sentence actually happened. The pacing is so calm and so deliberate, it's chilling. So if you want a better understanding of where Israel is today and why peace is so hard to reach, read this book, Killing a King. I'm loving it. I got the Kindle version. That's it. Yalla bye.
Daniel Estrin's book pick for the holidays. But we've got more. To check out the full list and find out why our correspondent in Turkey loves a book about North Korea, just head to facebook.com/PRI the world. Coming up, why the passing of Lonesome George, the tortoise in the Galapagos, may not have spelled the end for his species. That's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. A powerful typhoon rolled through an island in the central Philippines today, the same island that was slammed by Typhoon Haiyan just 2 years ago. This time, hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated before the storm hit. It's a reminder, just days after the Paris Climate Agreement, that a lot of work still has to be done to adapt to rising seas and stronger storms. Chris Bentley, with our partners at the Ground Truth Project, has more from Paris.
The mayor of a small coastal city in the Philippines has big plans. Her name is Stephanie Uitan, and she's just 32 years old.
I'm the first lady mayor and the youngest so far.
When Super Typhoon Haiyan was bearing down in 2013, Uitan's city, called Catbalogan, evacuated its coastal slums. But Haiyan's path shifted, largely sparing the city. Now Uitan is helping Catbalogan as it braces for yet another typhoon. When I talked to her at the climate conference in Paris last week, she worried about a crisis just like this.
Catbalogan is 3-in-1. We are very vulnerable to storm surge, flooding, and landslide. And I can't just imagine if we have, like, Super Typhoon number 5. I don't know where we will go.
Uitan wants to build a new climate-proof city center 400 feet uphill. She calls it Catbalogan Sky City.
All of our new businesses and housing will be there.
So wait, are you moving the city, basically?
Not the whole city, but for new houses, for those who are in the vulnerable side, we will be moving them up. That's the only way that the city could be safe.
Katbalogan's courting investors for the project, which could cost as much as $90 million.
We are very small. We lack resources. We lack the technical aspect. And so we need help technically and financially.
Uitan said she's not asking the world to bail out her city. She just wants the international community to help her reach investors and private developers. And that puts her in an odd but increasingly common position. She can't afford to defend her city from rising seas and superstorms, but she also can't afford not to. Cities like Katbalogan are already getting clobbered by climate change. They need money. There's the usual route of seeking money through United Nations funds and other international aid. But that's not enough, says Mina Raman, legal advisor to the Third World Network and a member advising the UN on its new climate finance arm, the Green Climate Fund.
Many of us are accessing that kind of money, but the pot is very little. There's a high demand. There's more demand than there is supply of money.
The Paris Agreement could bring a lot more private money into play. Secretary of State John Kerry said the deal sends a clear signal to the market. Invest in climate solutions or get left behind.
CEOs will begin to be asked the question, how are you doing for your shareholders relative to your responsibilities to live up to this? It's a sea change.
That sea change can't happen fast enough for those most vulnerable to climate change.
Not enough is being spent, but that doesn't mean that there's not enough in the world.
James Alexander is head of finance and economic development for a global consortium of cities called C40.
But look at the pension funds of the world. These things, if we can find ways to get things like pension funds, investment trusts, if we can get that money to flow in the right direction, not only will we be catalyzing the market, but we'll be creating a whole new sector of green infrastructure that there is enough money in the world to pay for.
There's trillions in pension funds looking for safe, long-term investments. Infrastructure projects are already attracting this kind of investment, so why not green infrastructure and projects to make cities more resilient? Not everyone's so excited about the prospect of globe-trotting financiers funding infrastructure in developing countries. Joanne Carling is head of the Asia Indigenous Peoples Pact, and she worries it could entrench inequality.
The way it's being approached is business as usual. It's again in the hands of business, all this renewable energy. They will set up windmill, they will set up solar and sell it to us, which we cannot afford, and it's done in our lands. That also impacts on our livelihoods.
The fact that businesses and banks might be getting bullish on climate change could still be good news for Stephanie Uitan, the Filipina mayor. She's plotting evacuation routes for sea level rise that could be decades away, and for storms that could pick up tomorrow. She'll take any help she can get, and she needs it now. For the world, Chris Bentley, Paris.
Finally today, remember Lonesome George, the last giant tortoise of his kind in the Galapagos Islands? Or so we thought when he died in 2012 at the age of about 100. Well, turns out Lonesome George had some long-lost relatives we didn't know about. And conservation biologist James Gibbs recently led an expedition in the Galapagos to round some of them up.
Lonesome George was the last member of the Pinta Island species of giant Galapagos tortoises. He was a striking individual, as was all members of his species, insofar as these were extremely saddleback tortoises. Saddlebacks are a unique adaptation found only in tortoises in the Galapagos among tortoises around the world.
So the saddleback, the shell near the neck is kind of pointed upward to allow the neck to raise up, the long neck?
Exactly. Usually in tortoises, that shell is domed. It comes right back down and a turtle can pull its head inside. But in this particular form of tortoise, it's flared, and that enables these animals to reach incredible heights, 4 or 5 feet up in the air to get at the cactus pads.
Now, it seemed like Lonesome George was the last of his species, but he may not be the last. What's happened?
There had been known for many decades that there was a strange pocket of tortoises on a very remote volcano on the northern end of Isabella Island. These are saddleback tortoises mixed in with dome tortoises. We were intrigued by this and did an expedition in 2008 to actually look for and take blood samples from these animals. They're completely different just based on their morphology or appearance, but the blood samples clearly identified that these were not just odd tortoises, but they were transplants from two islands where the tortoises are thought to have gone extinct. And one of those is Lonesome George's Island, Pinta. But the other is Floriana, which the tortoises have been extinct for so long, Darwin was the last person really to comment and write about them.
So these tortoises you're finding, do they look like Lonesome George? Or is it that they have similar DNA to Lonesome George?
Actually, both. In fact, one tortoise we took out, everybody's jaw just dropped. In fact, you could probably slip an image of him in and title it Lonesome George and nobody would know the difference.
So last month, you led an expedition down there and you brought back 32 of these giant tortoises to a research station. What are you going to do with them now?
They are just going to be left for at least a year until we determine their genetic identities. You know, we have a mixture of tortoises of very high quantities of the genomes of Pinta and Floriana and some hybrids with mixes with the native species. We have to see what we have and then we can develop a breeding plan. But then that probably next year will be begun. And who knows exactly the next steps, but it could be in as little as 5 years, some of the offspring from the tortoises of highest conservation value will actually be big enough, 5 years old, to be put back onto the original islands. So their offspring going back to Pinta and back to Floriana.
James Gibbs is a conservation biologist at the State University of New York. He recently led an expedition in the Galapagos to gather the descendants of Lonesome George. Thanks, James.
Thank you very much. Real pleasure.
And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.